Miami, Cubs again tonight in San Francisco. The White Sox host the Cardinals tonight. Northwoods League Baseball, the Kenosha Kingfish lost to the Kalamazoo Growlers 14-4 yesterday. Kingfish play the Mallards in Madison tonight. Now that WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Tuesday, July 10th. Sunny and hot, today's high 86, tonight's low 62. Look for 82 degrees on Wednesday. Here are the new numbers just in. Humidity 78%, wind from the north at 10. 75 degrees in Kenosha, 71 in Racine under a sunny sky. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Support also comes from UW Parkside, now offering the Sports Management Master's Degree Program. Students learn the business skills necessary to succeed in today's competitive sports environment. Flexible degrees for in-demand careers. More at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Next Tuesday, July 17th, 2018, will mark the 100th anniversary to the day of the brutal murders of Tsar Nicholas II, his wife Alexandra, their five children, and four loyal servants. Best-selling author Helen Rappaport has written a series of fascinating books about the Romanov family and about Russia at this point in their history. Her books include Caught in the Revolution, Petrograd, Russia in 1917, A World on the Edge, The Romanov Sisters, The Lost Lives of the Daughters of Nicholas and Alexandra, and The Last Days of the Romanovs, Tragedy at Ekaterinburg. Helen Rappaport thought that perhaps she had written all that there was for her to write about the Romanovs, and then upon further reflection realized that there was still more to say about the tragedy that ultimately engulfed the family. The result is her latest book, perhaps the most fascinating of them all, titled The Race to Save the Romanovs, The Truth Behind the Secret Plans to Rescue the Russian Imperial Family, published by St. Martin's Press.
Once they get into your head, you know, there is something very seductive about them and their story, and something very compelling and moving. And of course, about this time 11 years ago, I was actually in Ekaterinburg, walking the streets of Ekaterinburg, walking the city, reliving the story in my head when I wrote my first book about them, which covered just the last 2 weeks of their lives held captive in the city, inside that house, and what went on in that very short scenario. And while I walked the city, They really began to inhabit my imagination in a way that no other subject has. And I found myself often thinking about the four girls, the four lovely sisters, who really history has somewhat overlooked and has assumed they're not particularly interesting. They're just pretty uncontroversial girls in the background. And so I then went on and wrote a book about their lives and their hopes and dreams and aspirations, which became, in a way, this is the Romanov sisters that fortuitously did so well in America. This became, in a way, a domestic history of the Romanovs, because what interested me and continues to interest me about the family is their private life at home. I'm not interested in power and politics and big issues. I'm interested in the parts of the story that are in the footnotes, the parts you don't normally get in books. So having explored them as a family so in such detail and so intimately, there was just this final question in my mind that would not go away, which is, why couldn't anyone save them? Why could nobody get them out? And I thought I was done with them, but it kept that question kept going round and round in my head, and I thought, no, I have got to explore this.
And we're so glad you did. But what a monumental task. One of the things that, and we'll talk about this at greater length in just a little bit, but one of the things that makes this question especially complicated is this sprawling family tree of various royal figures spread throughout Europe. And all of these various relatives could potentially have offered asylum or offered some kind of assistance that might have led to the salvation of the family, and that ultimately never happened. But in other words, there were all of these possibilities, and you needed to
be related,
right? And so you needed to
be related to most of the royal houses of Europe.
And so you had the task then, an incredibly complicated task of exploring all of these different possibilities. I want you to just speak for a moment as a historian about the way in which you set about to research this as thoroughly as you did, and the places you had to go, and the small army of assistants, archivists and translators and so on, that were indispensable in this effort for you.
Well, the problem with this whole story, and you might have to prompt me because I'm not sure if I can remember all those questions you've asked there. The problem with this story is that really until my book, it's been told in a very narrow way. People have boiled it down almost to the solitary issue of it was all the fault of King George V of Britain, who didn't get them out because, you know, he was first cousin to Nicholas and to Alexandra. And you know, it was all down to him and his government offering a plan to get them out, offering asylum. But the fact is, you know, they weren't the only royal relatives that the Romanovs had. They were related to almost every other major house in Europe. But the problem was that most of the, certainly the Scandinavian houses, they were all neutral during the war and anxious not to tread on anyone's toes. And what you see happening when you start looking at the evidence is how internal national politics played a major decisive role in the extent to which anyone was able to help the Romanovs. And in order to really get into the detail and see what the position was of the different families, I needed to look at sources well beyond English language sources. So it meant, in the end, I covered about 8 languages, sources in Norwegian, Swedish, Danish, Russian, French, Spanish, what was the other one? I've lost track now. I know it was 8 languages anyway,
and Russian,
because I needed to cast the net really wide to find more context and more detail on what was going on within these different houses in Europe, because the difficulty for any monarch at the time, and it didn't just relate to King George, was that all of them effectively were constitutional monarchs, so they had no power. They had no personal executive power to suddenly up and say, go and save them. So even King George, and this is one of the very first misconceptions in this story, King George had no power to order a rescue or an evacuation or anything else. He was entirely dependent on his government offering to do so. And it was the same with all the other monarchs. But the important thing right at the very beginning of the story was, in fact, that the British government didn't immediately jump up and down and say, oh, come to England, we'll welcome you with open arms. In fact, all of the governments, for various political reasons, were very reluctant to take in the Tsar and Tsaritsa of Russia. And in the end, what happened, within a week or so of the abdication, it was down to the new Russian provisional government constantly putting pressure on the Brits through their ambassador in Petrograd, who kept saying, please take them in, please take them off our hands. So there was no immediate jumping up and down and desire by anyone to get them out, because they all realized this could be very politically compromising.
Right. And I suppose in part of one of the reasons there was this, in a sense, collective hesitancy is because there were so many potential options. And in a sense, that kind of diluted a sense of responsibility. If there had been one plausible possibility out there, whoever that was, they might have been willing to take on the political cost of trying to do something. But when you had all of these different people and it's kind of this scenario of, well, no, why don't you do it? Or why don't you do it? Or it's I think someone else can do it.
Yeah, no. And you see, thing is, even King Alfonso of Spain, who of all of them made the most consistent and constant representations trying to help the family, even he was warned, as King George V had been clearly warned, and it's what made him kind of fall back on the idea. He was warned, as was Alfonso, if you have the Tsar and Tsaritsa of Russia, with their terrible reputation for being despots and autocrats and murdering people and, you know, the pogroms and this, that, and the other, if you bring them to your country, this will incite unrest among the left-wing and socialist sympathizers in your country who already are celebrating the revolution. You see, the issue was that Nicholas and Alexandra had for the last 12 years since 1905, the most appalling political record, and that went before them. They were very controversial monarchs, and for any foreign power to offer them a refuge could have been extremely politically compromising.
And that was something that none of them was willing to take on at that point
in time. No, not at all. Hmm. Not at all. What it boiled down to really was they would all mutter amongst themselves, you know, particularly the Norwegians, the Swedes and the Danes. They all talked about sending ships and offering a bit of help, and maybe if they got them out of Russia, they could pass them on to someone else and transport them somewhere else, you know, and all kinds of places were discussed. But none of them actually wanted to commit to the true politically dangerous decision of saying, yes, we will have them come and live in our country. And so really they were sort of passed around like a political hot potato from one country to another, all saying, well, we can't take them in, but we might be able to give you some money or send a ship or do something. And so they were all very non-committal, really. And then the final biggest difficulty was that although the Kaiser wanted to be some kind of Teutonic hero and offer Nicholas and Alexandra a refuge, because he was their cousin as well, Kaiser Wilhelm, the problem was that Nicholas and Alexandra both despised him. And they said quite categorically, we'd rather die in Russia than be saved by the Germans. So that was another problem, because when Russia and Germany agreed a peace deal at the Brest-Litovsk conference in the spring of 1918, the Germans were best placed then to press for the Romanovs to be allowed out of Russia. But the Romanovs, in fact, had they even been offered help by the Germans, would have said no. And that's just another part of what becomes an incredibly complicated scenario.
And obviously a scenario in which there was no plausible means of escape.
There would have been a possibility, I don't think, of escape. Some kind of secret escape would have been far too difficult. The only real opportunity for getting them out in an orderly kind of evacuation with the cooperation of the provisional government, with the Kaiser agreeing a British ship would be allowed out on a white flag to take them out from the northern Russian coast. That might have been possible if they'd all got their act together really quickly, right after the abdication in March. But once time moved on and everyone prevaricated and hedged their bets and wasn't sure what they wanted to do, the whole internal situation in Russia became intensely difficult, because you have the old bourgeoisie and the old liberal government, vestiges of the old liberal state Duma, trying to set up a new government as the provisional government, coming up against an extremely radical Petrograd Soviet, which were the revolutionaries who had their rival organization, who were demanding nothing less than the trial and probably execution of Nicholas.
And of course, eventually the intention is that the entire family must be murdered, because I think it was in the words of Lenin, he did not want any of them to remain as a potential banner for those who
a
might...
A living banner, yes.
Right.
For that was the problem, you see. It wasn't just a matter of... The thing that the radicals objected to was Nicholas and Alexander in particular being allowed out into some kind of comfortable exile abroad. They said there was a price to pay for 300 years of Romanov despotism. They had to pay for all their many mistakes as rulers. They had to be put on trial. Unfortunately, they had five beautiful, innocent children who did not deserve to be so savagely murdered. But, of course, Lenin's attitude was that you can't let the children survive, because if the children survive, they could become a rallying point for a counter-revolution.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with best-selling author Helen Rappaport about her newest book, which is called The Race to Save the Romanovs, The Truth Behind the Secret Plans to Rescue the Russian Imperial Family. I so appreciate the thoroughness with which you tell this story and the rich historical background which you lay out for us. And in particular, in the very first chapter of the book called Happy Families, you explain this sprawling family tree of which the Tsar and his wife were a part. And we've already kind of touched on that. Just say a word about this extraordinary family tree and in a sense, what sort of unforeseen ramifications there were about this kind of royal intermarrying between all of these various constituencies?
Well, the first and most important thing is that the vast majority of the then living European royals in 1917 were in one way or another descended from or connected to Queen Victoria. So they all had close family relationships. But of course, when the war broke out, in 1914, those loyalties were divided between those European royal families who sided with the Germans and those who sided with the allies of Russia, France, and Britain. And so there were a lot of problems for the European royals, because most of them, I think I've already mentioned, Scandinavians in particular, stayed neutral. But even the neutral ones had their sympathies often. But didn't hide their sympathies. For example, I think it was a Swedish king had a German wife, and it created a lot of conflict within the actual wider Romanov family, because, in fact, some of them actually were much more pro-German than pro-British and French. So there were lots of divided loyalties. There's lots of conflict. But also into that mix of, you know, these royal houses effectively having to take sides in the war, was the added complication that most of them hated Alexandra. They really intensely disliked her. They found her stuck up, difficult, very severe, very intense about her religion, very judgmental. And most of them found her extremely difficult to get on with. And that, too, I think, created a subtext of, do we really want her in the country? And I know, well, I can't prove it, but one of the suggestions has been made that one of the reasons King George changed his mind was that his wife, Queen Mary, was violently hostile to the idea of Alexandra coming to Britain. I think if Nicholas had not been married to a German, and this is the other issue, you know, Britain's fighting a war with Germany. To have an ex-empress who's actually German by birth again complicates things. And if Nicholas perhaps had not had a German wife, it might have been easier to get them out. But you know, it was quite shocking when I researched the background and I was writing that first chapter, trying to explain all the different family attitudes and connections. It was quite shocking to see the extent to which all Alexandra's royal relatives were saying horrible things behind her back. And I do think in many ways she's been very vilified and certainly demonized, if not by her relatives, and also by history. And of course, that's because a lot to do with her relationship with Rasputin.
Right. Can you say a quick word about Queen Victoria's relationship with Alexandra, her granddaughter, and also her serious misgivings that she had about Alexandra marrying into Russian royalty?
Well, traditionally, Queen Victoria and the Victorians generally have been pretty Russophobic throughout most of the 19th century. First of all, there was, you know, the horrible war in Crimea in the 1850s. And later on, there were run-ins with the Russians in Afghanistan. And the Queen Victoria was deeply mistrustful of the Russians. She found them difficult to understand, difficult to judge or second-guess. And her attitude always was that she did not want any of her precious granddaughters to marry into the Russian royal family. Well, of course, it happened twice, because prior to Alexandra marrying Nicholas the Tsarevich, her older sister, Ella, had, in, I think it's 1883, had married a Russian Grand Duke, Sergei, who was later blown to pieces by the revolutionaries. And the Queen was very, very prescient and very worried about the two sisters marrying into Russia. And when Alexandra announced she wanted to marry Nikki in 1894, the Queen said, you know, this is such an unsafe throne. I really worry about the safety of Alexandra and Nicholas himself, because she was very aware of the level of political assassination and the growth of the revolutionary movement. So, in fact, the Queen fairly accurately foresaw that Alex marrying into the Russian royal family was going to be full of doom and gloom. Mm. And the other tragic thing, of course, was that little did she know, Queen Victoria herself passed on the haemophilia gene through her daughter Alice, who married into the Hesse family, who was Alexandra's mother. And Alexandra, in turn, was the carrier of haemophilia, which was passed on to her son, Tsarevich. And that haemophilia link, you know, crops up in other members of the family, all, you know, in each case coming down through Victoria, because in fact, the wife of King Alfonso of Spain, who actually did so much to try and help the Ronos, his wife, Ina, was another granddaughter of Victoria's, who also unknowingly was a haemophilia carrier and took the disease into the Spanish royal family. So there was an inheritance coming down from Victoria that what really was extremely tragic, because many of the things that put Alexandra and Nicholas on the road to ruin was that they had a haemophiliac son, and they espoused all these quacks and healers and people. I'm not saying Rasputin was a quack, but the way in which they obsessively pursued help for their son and embraced Rasputin led in a way to their downfall.
One of the other factors in the downfall that Tsar Nicholas is the fact that he became Tsar so much earlier and abruptly than anyone would have ever anticipated, and this is probably very significant in terms of some of the mistakes that he made. Explain the circumstances under which he became Tsar, and what significance you think that has in terms of the way in which he led Russia.
Nicholas was totally unprepared to be Tsar. He'd had a very narrow education. He had really been a military man. He'd had absolutely no real preparation or training in statesmanship. and all the business of government. And a lot of this was because his father died so young and unexpectedly in his 40s of kidney disease in November of 1894. Nicholas said with absolute horror and tears in his eyes, that he wasn't ready for the job. It's as simple as that. He was ill-prepared, frightened. He felt lacking in confidence to take on such it is a poison chalice, taking on being Tsar of that enormous empire with all the difficult political issues going on. He was very overwhelmed by the task. And the problem really with Nicholas, I always feel this the more I read about him and the family, was he was fundamentally a kind, caring, loving, hands-on father and family man. And he would have been only too happy to live in obscurity, in a country house somewhere, digging the garden and chopping wood and being with his wife and children. He really was not cut out to be Tsar. And because he was not cut out for the job, he ended up relying on ministers who were rather right-wing and narrow-minded and gave him bad advice. And he made some seriously bad decisions politically. For example, 1905, when the Cossacks charged peaceful marchers in January and mowed them down. Bloody Sunday, 1905, was the beginning of his very tainted reputation. And then that came on the heels of a disastrous war with Japan, 1904-5. He thought they'd get a quick and easy victory, and it actually was an absolute stalemate, and they're very heavy losses. And, he made some very, very bad decisions in that respect. And then the worst one of all, I think, was after the war broke out in 1915, he decided to take over command of the army himself and left the city, left Petrograd, as it was then called in the war, and went hundreds of miles westward to take over the command of the army on the Eastern Front, which meant he lost touch with what was really going on in Petrograd. And that's the point at which there's all this gossip and innuendo and accusations that Alexandra was running the country with Rasputin. And I think if Nicholas had known what was really going on in the capital, particularly once the disturbances started, if he'd come back straight away, he might have been able to diffuse the trouble. So there are many wrong decisions he made. But in many ways, he was a decent man who tried to do the best for his country. And fundamentally, at heart, he was deeply, deeply, devotedly patriotic, devoutly Russian Orthodox, devoted family man. And, you have to weigh the failures against the pluses. That's why I say if he hadn't been Tsar, he probably would have lived a very happy and fairly obscure life.
We have already touched on, but we need to explore a little further, the deep animosity that so many felt towards Alexandra. And we've already touched on the fact that, to a shocking extent, she was disliked and or distrusted by many of her own relatives. And you describe how astounded you were as you began to discover this in exploring various archives and files. I think what we have not yet really talked about was the attitude of at least many of the Russians themselves towards Alexandra. Describe what those feelings were, and also, in a sense, the kind of downward arc that is the way in which her standing in the eyes of most Russians deteriorated over time.
Well, it was a very simple fundamental problem that Nicholas and Alexander were so far removed from the population at large that they were remote figures. They didn't know who they were, except they'd been taught to believe that the Tsar and Tsaritsa were little father and little mother, of the nation. And but ordinary Russians hardly came into contact with them. And they did shut themselves away. And the reason this happened was that when Alex A was born in 1904 and they discovered he had haemophilia, they immediately closed ranks. They didn't live at the Winter Palace and do the social season in the capital in St. Petersburg. They retreated to their home at Tsarskoye-Selo, the Alexander Palace, and lived a very closed, protected domestic life. And as such, the Russian people didn't see very much of them. And the other problem was Alexandra herself despised St. Petersburg society. She thought it was corrupt and decadent. She didn't want her children exposed to it. She didn't want her lovely young daughters to mix in St. Petersburg society. She very closely controlled who they could meet with and associate with, which was basically people from their own entourage, their close entourage of officers and ladies-in-waiting. So in that sense, she was so mistrustful of people that she effectively cut herself and her children off from Russian society. But the other major factor, and it really did affect things, was that she was a very sick woman. She suffered from a whole spectrum of complaints and problems, some real, some maybe psychosomatic. All her life, she suffered from agonizing sciatica. She suffered from migraines and facial neuralgia and otitis, inflammation of the ear, insomnia. She was a very fussy eater. She was almost a vegetarian, I think. And she was just such a difficult person that I don't think the ordinary Russian people, had they seen her, could have related to her. And so the only opportunity, really, that the Russian people had to see their monarchs and the children, or as a whole unit, was in 1913 when they had the Romanov tercentenary, the 300th anniversary of the Romanov rule. And they did this sort of tour and went to Moscow and went to various towns in and around Moscow. And people, you know, did actually have a chance of seeing the family. But so often, on occasions, like big celebrations, the Russian victory at Borodino, there was an enormous celebration of that battle from the Napoleonic Wars, the Russian battle. Alexandra, you know, kept out of sight, really. She always had an excuse for not doing big occasions. If she could get out of it, she would have a headache or feel ill or come for half an hour and then go back home again. So fundamentally, the issue was she was very remote from the Russian people. But the obverse of that, and this again is really part of her tragedy, is that the people who knew her, the really close personal friends from the inner circle, the very close ladies-in-waiting and servants within the imperial entourage, the people who knew her and whom she trusted, said you could not have had a more loving, devoted, kind, and generous friend. But you see, the ordinary people never saw that side of her.
Such a shame.
And that's the trouble. Whereas Nicholas was more accessible. And of course, the people worshipped Alexei the Tsarevich. You know, he was the hope of Russia, this beautiful young boy. But they didn't know he was carrying the fatal gene and that haemophilia will probably kill him soon. And so it becomes such a compelling, tragic story that I think that's why it sticks in people's imaginations, you know, and people are endlessly fascinated by it.
By the way, in this chapter called Some Catastrophe Lurking in the Dark, where you kind of lay out the deterioration of the royal family's standing with the Russian people, one of the things you described that I had never heard described in this way before was, in a sense, what life was like for the Romanov daughters in these years, in which it was not only Alexandra withdrawing from public life, more and more protective of her son, but the daughters were, in a sense, pulled into that same removal from public life. And you write at one point, they seemed so neglected and hardly went out, spending their days forever at their mother's beck and call. The sad reality of their lives was that far from being out and about enjoying the company of people of their own age and social status, they had by now become carers and protectors of their ailing mother and hemophiliac brother. Alexandra had always disapproved of her daughter's mixing in decadent St. Petersburg society, as she saw it. A trip to the opera or ballet with their father before the onset of war had been a major event in their lives. Mm. And so their social circle was a tightly controlled one of a few close female members of Alexandra's entourage and the hand-picked guards. I mean, in a sense, these four Romanov daughters were already hostages, in a sense.
Oh, absolutely.
Not at gunpoint, but in a sense, it's a sad precursor of what they would experience in the last year and a half of their lives.
But you see, by then, they were so used to always being mother's little helpers. I mean, occasionally they got stroppy with her, particularly Olga, the eldest one. But what you mainly see when you look at them, the letters they wrote, and the occasional diary entries that survived, is how uncomplaining they were, how much they accepted that this was their role to be with mother and sit with her and read to her and knit with her when she was unwell or lying down, or to sit with Alexei and amuse him when he'd had another attack of bleeding and was unwell. And they were so devoted. They were so loyal. I think that's why I wanted to write the book about the four of them, if only to show what exemplary young women they were. Hmm. And not just pretty girls in big hats and white frocks, real caring, loving, decent human beings who had so many disappointments too. Hmm. And like you say, you know, a big, big highlight of their life would be a trip to the ballet in Petersburg with their father, or to go to the theater or the opera. They adored being in their father's company. And then the worst of it, of course, is in the war years, particularly the eldest two girls, when they trained as nurses, suddenly they are exposed to a succession of handsome, wounded young officers brought to their hospital in Saskia-Sulok, because they're nursing there, and they start falling in love with men they could never hope to marry. And it's so sad, because I think if Nicholas and Alexandra could at least allow the eldest two girls to get married to whoever they wanted, they might have been safely married and living somewhere away from, you know, when the revolution happened.
We're speaking with Helen Rappaport, author of The Race to Save the Romanovs. Of course, most of our listeners know well the dramatic events in which Nicholas begins to lose grip of power and ultimately is forced to abdicate. You point out that there is a great irony in this moment in which he makes this important decision to abdicate, that he makes this decision in complete isolation from his wife, unlike nearly every other significant political decision that he made during his reign up until that time.
Yes, absolutely. I do believe he would never have abdicated if she'd been there. She wouldn't have allowed it. She would have fought tooth and nail. She would have had one of her hissy fits. In fact, he said once that he would rather have 10 Rasputins than one of Alexandra's neurotic sort of outburst, because she was extremely controlling and difficult. She would never have allowed him to abandon the throne, to give up the throne that they were preserving for their darling boy. Her whole universe was centered around Alexei, the longed-for son, and to see him become Tsar one day, to pass on this glorious legacy to him. She would never, ever have agreed to Nicholas abdicating.
The family, of course, is eventually brought together and, of course, transported to several different sites, and it would seem under increasingly tight guard. And it became clear, especially by the time they were in their last location, that a simple sort of rescue and certainly a simple sort of escape was all but impossible. Just yeah. trace for our listeners the most important sort of hallmarks of this time of imprisonment and their hopes that eventually dwindled to despair that they might possibly be rescued.
Well, you have to first of all be aware that their idea of rescue would never have they didn't want it to involve any kind of bloodshed and people being killed. Their idea of rescue was somehow miraculously being spirited away and being hidden somewhere in Russia. They didn't really want to leave Russia. They were frightened if they fled Russia, they would never be allowed to go back again. And I think, you know, as time went on in captivity, it became increasingly clear to them that there's no way anyone could have done some kind of heroic attack on where they were being held and try and get them out of there without there being a massacre. At Tobolsk, the first place they were sent to in Western Siberia, it might have been possible because the guards there were more lax and might have turned a blind eye. They were more sympathetic. But once the family were moved to Ekaterinburg, which is a very, very red, very Bolshevik town, but with a lot of really hardline Bolsheviks and revolutionaries, that the whole system under which they were held captive was much tighter. And it just would have been impossible to get them out of there. And the other factor I think that I really wanted people to stop and think about in terms of any rescue of the family, and it's the one that no one has paid any real attention to till now, is the sheer logistics, the distances, the weather. How do you get seven people from Western Siberia north right to the Russian sea coast, the Arctic coast, to a ship at Murmansk or Archangel, or out to the far east of Vladivostok to safety across the Pacific to USA or Japan? I mean, these were enormous distances. They would, to get the family out anywhere would have required a very sophisticated, well-oiled, well-organized network of people, safe houses, transport, food. And in order to do that, you would have needed, first of all, funding, a lot of funding, but you would also have needed people with the skills and ability to do it. And quite honestly, the Russian monarchists who kept coming up with all these half-baked ideas about rescuing the family, they just couldn't have done it. They were too poorly organized. They were, they just didn't have the expertise.
Hmm. I think one of the most sort of troubling, tragic details about this time of captivity was that at certain points in time, when their captors were tricking the Romanovs into false hopes about an impending rescue. Just say a very quick word about what I'm talking about.
Well, there was a series of supposed letters from officers, i.e. loyal monarchist, Russian monarchist officers, that were smuggled into the Ipatiev house in Ekaterinburg, suggesting to the Romanovs that all these loyal, gallant white Russians were at this very minute plotting to come in and rescue them and take them away to safety. The letters were fairly ineptly written, and although the first one that was smuggled in might well have been genuine, it's pretty clear now that it was intercepted by the commandant and at the house. And the Bolsheviks decided to carry on this pretense of copying that letter and sending in some more, purporting to come from monarchist sympathizers, just to test the water of what the Romanov's response would be, so that if, as happened, the Romanov started responding in little notes that were smuggled back out saying, yes, well, we'll listen for your signal, but remember, it's going to be difficult for us to get out because Alexei is sick, etc. But basically to show they were willing to collude in some kind of rescue could later have been used as justification for their murder by saying, well, look, they were plotting to run away, they were plotting to escape. It's a very nasty provocation, but we are still lacking sufficient evidence to really pinpoint it.
Mm. It's also striking that we read in your book from the journals of various relatives in these other countries the real horror that they felt on hearing the news of the abdication. This is even before they hear of the murder, the horror they felt. And yet somehow that horror and concern never could be translated into any sort of concrete action to perhaps save the Romanovs.
Well, one of the things I think I show in the opening chapter is the extent to which several of their royal relatives tried to save Nicholas and Alexander from themselves. They kept warning them, saying, you know, you're heading for the edge of the precipice. You've got to make concessions in Russia politically. You've got to reform. You've got to answer some of the demands of the working people, you know, for better conditions, etc. So the relatives could see the writing on the wall, as too could the diplomats who were in the capital at the time, who were, including the American ambassador, David R. Francis, the British ambassador, George Buchanan, all were talking amongst themselves saying, Nicholas isn't, you know, he's so blinkered, he won't listen to us, he's riding for a fall, his empire is going to crash. So everyone tried to stop that happening.
And they, of course, could not. One chilling detail at the towards the end of the book is you describe that terrible night when the Romanovs are taken away, and they have no idea until someone bursts in with guns and they are shot and killed, is that some of the men originally given the responsibility of carrying out that deed refused. They were unwilling to shoot the daughters. And so it was actually a smaller number of murderers who actually ended up carrying out the deed and did so in sort of chaotic fashion. I mean, it could not have been a more brutal end for the Romanovs.
Well, you've got to imagine, locked up in that house day and night with just a small exercise, a garden to exercise in the back, the girls were in very close proximity to their captors. And what happens is this Stockholm syndrome where captors and captives become sympathetic and become friendly and they like each other because the girls were so bored. They just wanted to engage in conversation. And many of the guards were very, very young, you know, some in their late teens and early 20s. And they engaged with the girls. They chatted to them. The girls showed them their photographs and albums and things like that. So they became a bit too friendly, and it was really that became a real issue, because when Yurovsky, the commandant, was planning the killing and allotting which guard would kill which member of the family, several said, well, we're not going to kill the girls. They're perfectly nice girls. They're sweet. They're lovely. Why on earth should we kill them? What have they done to deserve being killed? Interestingly, though, they generally all accepted that killing the boy, because he was the heir to the throne, you know, he, if anything, was that living banner, the Tsarevich. But they were very, very reluctant to harm the girls. So the assassination squad, or whatever you want to call them, they certainly want an execution squad, because they did it so badly, were about four people short.
A savage moment, certainly. And, of course, it's a long time before the Soviet government willingly admits that not only had the Tsar and his wife been murdered, but also these five children.
This is the beginning of the Russian art of fake news. It began almost immediately after the Romanovs were killed, the disinformation, the confusion. You know, if you want to undermine your enemies, you confuse them, you tell them lies, you say one thing and then change your mind and tell them something else. And so for weeks and weeks after the killings, although it was pretty clear Nicholas had been killed and the Bolsheviks actually admitted to that, they kept pretty shtum, or they confused people about what had happened to Alexander and the children, because, of course, politically, that was a horrific thing to do.
Helen Rappaport is responsible for this fascinating and meticulously researched new book titled The Race to Save the Romanovs, The Truth Behind the Secret Plans to Rescue the Russian Imperial Family, published by St. Martin's Press. I'm Gregory Berg. And tomorrow on the morning show, among other things, we will be previewing for you the Four Seasons Garden Club's Secret Garden Walk, which is coming up